Beginning this afternoon with the pandemic bonuses, the majority of healthcare workers in Ireland have still not been paid the pandemic bonus payment of up to €1,000 as a gesture of gratitude. I am joined now by the Chief Executive of Nursing Homes Ireland, that is Tadhg Daly. You're very welcome to join me this afternoon, Tadhg.
Thanks again, Ciara. Good afternoon to you.
So this tax-free payment is to the wages of staff. It was first announced in January 2022, and it could contribute to the Irish Independent is wording here, a well-earned holiday. But it has emerged that approximately 45,000 staff in private nursing homes, which saw some of the saddest days of the pandemic, especially in the early days of the pandemic, along with thousands of employees in hospices, are even further behind and waiting for this pandemic bonus. They're formally waiting for the Department of Health to give the green light for the rollout. Why the wait?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, Ciara. And it's baffling at this stage, given, as you've just said, that it was announced on the 19th of January, in fact. And I think, I suppose, it's important to put it into context. This is a very, very good decision, a very welcome decision, and it is, as you say, I suppose, a recognition of the fact that people on the front line, particularly in nursing homes, hospices, etc., you know, did a sterling job in the early part of COVID. So, look, the decision is the right decision, but it is disappointing to date that it hasn't been paid, obviously, but also, I suppose, the uncertainty around when, because that's the key question now that we have, is the methodology for the rollout and payment of it, and when is it likely to be paid, because people need to make plans. You know, many people may have it already factored into their budget for this year, as you've said, around the summer holidays. So I suppose our call now is to just, you know, as I say, is to expedite this and, you know, communicate with ourselves so that we can in turn inform all the staff across the country.
I mean, many people may have factored it in, as you say, back in January, but to what they may have factored using the €1,000 for in their, you know, monthly, weekly, yearly budget may have completely changed. Because as we know, in January 2022, the world really was a very different place. The invasion of Ukraine didn't happen until the end of February. We have seen, you know, the cost of fuel. We've seen the cost of electricity, you know, jumps everywhere. Inflation still rising, still continuing to do so. There's now talk of, is there a possible recession coming? A worldwide, that is. A lot of people are saying, no, the bubble will burst. But if this is the case and these people still are yet to receive this €1,000, I'm sure it's a worry, because this 1,000 may have been seen as a bonus, but now it's probably essential to their day-to-day life.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it definitely was a recognition payment, as you said. And I mean, given that all of us now are facing, you know, double-digit increases in our daily lives, our shopping, our fuel, our lighting and heating, for many of them, as you say, it is absolutely essential. So, you know, look, as I say, it was the right decision. There was a lot of positivity around it when it was announced. But, you know, if government don't move quickly and ensure that it's rolled out quickly, it does take some of the shine off it. Look, ultimately, it's a significant amount of money for many people. It's up to €1,000 tax-free. You know, that's very, very positive. But, you know, the waiting and the uncertainty and the not knowing. I mean, all of us, you know, even if they said in the morning it's going to be in, you know, August, God forbid, you know, people would know and they'd be able to say, well, look, I can plan around that, or it can help me maybe with back to school costs, or I could maybe go to the credit union in the meantime, you know, on the back of it. It's the fact that we still don't know either the procedure around it or indeed the date of payment.
So the pandemic bonus is for frontline workers in a COVID-19 exposed environment for at least 4 weeks. That was from the 1st of March 2020 to the 30th of June 2021. And it does range from €600 to €1,000. That depends how the frontline worker, met 60% of the full-time hours for their grade. You're speaking about, you know, frustration to a degree, Tadhg. You have said that, you know, your staff, in terms of nursing home staff, that is, were at the front line of an unprecedented health emergency which took great toll on their well-being as they valiantly, as you rightly point out, strive to protect the most vulnerable from the pandemic. So with your comments that you've made, I'm assuming you've already been on to government or even government officials. And if so, what have they said back to you at Nursing Homes Ireland?
Yeah, I suppose, absolutely, we have been in touch with government all the way through this, and as I said, you know, we were very welcoming of the initiative at the outset, and it's a measure of the decision of government, and particularly the Minister Harris, or Minister Donnelly rather, and indeed Minister McGrath, don't know who. But in January and in February, we've been in contact, and at that stage, it was very early days. So we were very encouraged in April when we saw, as you said there, I suppose the terms and conditions around the disbursement of the payment to the HSE facility. So we would have expected to be mirroring that in the private sector and indeed in the hospices and the many other Section 39 agencies across the country. But in effect, what the government have said is they're still walking through it. I mean, that was the announcement in April. And to date, we haven't got any further clarity on that. So that's the frustration, really, is that when we're likely to get, you know, full visibility of it and confirmation of when it's going to be paid. So still up in the air, unfortunately.
Yeah, the Department of Health has said that they're, as we know, yet to give their final go-ahead for the rollout. You've noted approximately 35,000 full-time staff and then another 10,000 part-time staff will qualify. Just to touch on that staff at the moment, we know that COVID-19 rates have lowered significantly. We expected this, you know, 2 years into the pandemic, over 2 years now. We know that in the warmer months due to ventilation and the fact that people aren't, you know, stuck inside the whole time, the rate of any virus to spread is going to be much less. What are the scenes like at the moment in Ireland's nursing homes? How are the staff coping, obviously, because, as you said, they valiantly strived to ensure the most vulnerable were kept as safe as possible during the pandemic?
Yeah, look, it's been a very, very difficult and challenging 2 years, as you quite rightly point out, and, you know, it's well rehearsed at this stage. So people are very tired, I would say, but also somewhat relieved because of the efficacy of the vaccine. I mean, the vaccine has been life-changing, obviously, for people generally, but also those in the nursing home sector. So what we're trying to do now is, I suppose, get back to, you know, pre-COVID times. I mean, just recently, we've had engagement with the Health Protection Surveillance Centre around the guidance around managing COVID. And at the moment, for the last number of months, you'll be aware people were still wearing FFP2 masks. Whereas now, what they're saying is that, you know, without, if it's not patient-facing for less than 50 minutes, that a clinical mask will suffice. So we're trying to get back to normal. Activities are happening again in nursing
homes. So, if it's not patient-facing for more than 15 minutes?
For more than 15 minutes, okay. Yeah, a clinical mask will be sufficient.
So does that mean if I go in to visit, you know, whoever it may be in the nursing home,
yes,
that I can walk in with a clinical grade mask?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're less than 15 minutes, I suppose if it's longer than that, you know, there will be a risk assessment done on each occasion. I mean, you know, but we are in a much, much different place. So what we need to do is get back to, you know, relative normality. And that's why the activities programs, you know, music, art, the National Arts and Nursing Homes Day was held a number of weeks ago, as you know. So, you know, nursing homes is a person's home, in essence. It's not their own home, but it's as close as you can make it to be. So it is a social care setting. So that's why the pandemic was, you know, I suppose, so difficult on the nursing home sector, because, you know, nursing homes, day-to-day activity, you know, quality of life is hugely important. So there is a sense of some normality, but still, you know, people are very cautious, and rightly so, because many relatives and families and indeed staff are still quite cautious. COVID It hasn't gone away. Clearly, it's very much in the rearview mirror, but it hasn't gone away completely. So there's still vigilance there, but that's, I suppose, trying to deal with that in an environment where we try to move on as well and give people back that quality of life, which is hugely, hugely important.
So a lot of people like myself would have known absolutely nothing to very, very little about infection control prior to this pandemic. It's still declared. And what we, people like myself who didn't know much, what we've learned is that planning is key. We are in the 31st or on the 31st of May now. So coming into June, coming into the warmer months, you know, up until September, it is by and large quite warm in this country, and meaning there'll be better ventilation, etc. But my question to you is, what is in place or what discussions are currently happening, Tadhg, for the autumn-winter season?
Winter. Yeah, look, clearly there will be increased vigilance again as we head into the winter time. I mean, the guidance...
But increased vigilance, what does that mean? Because...
Well, I suppose it depends on the nature of the virus. It depends if the virus is still live in our communities. I mean, community transmission is the single biggest contributor to an outbreak in any setting.
Okay, do you have specific, schemes or setups depending on what rate the virus potentially spreads at in the autumn, winter? Yeah. Do you have different scenarios for each potential in terms of how the virus will act?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, what you have now, I suppose, is that the experience that people have been through over the last 2 years, it has evolved over that time. So, you know, contingency planning, the guidance that we spoke of there a few moments ago in relation to the Health Protection Surveillance Centre, all of that has been constantly reviewed. And that's why I said that there's an easing of the restrictions around mask wearing, for example. Now, that may change again. If there is an increased of the virus in the community. So this is under constant monitoring. Clearly, we've had people who've had their second booster. Again, we'll be guided by the WHO and indeed public health generally. You know, will there be an annual booster, for example, required? Clearly, the flu vaccine will be happening in September, October. So all of the, I suppose, annual measures will then be supplemented by any particular measures that will be required to deal particularly with COVID. But that will be based on science, it will be based on public health advices, and it will be based on the trajectory of the virus at that particular time. Because, you know, we know that if it gets into a setting such as a hospital or indeed a nursing home, it can be hugely, hugely challenging. Now, that said, the vaccine has been hugely effective. So vaccination is a huge, huge part of the mitigation measures, if you like, but that will also require the guidance, maybe guidance around visiting, guidance around mask wearing, guidance around ventilation. You know, there are many elements to it, and no one element, is superior. We have to monitor all of that and ultimately be guided by public health.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you, Tadhg, for joining me. That is the Chief Executive of Nursing Homes Ireland, Tadhg Daly there. And we do know a huge majority of the Irish public did decide to get vaccinated against COVID-19, especially when it came to the first and second dose of the vaccine. If we look elsewhere, a spokesperson for the Ireland East Hospital Group. Now, NACE, for example, isn't in that. NACE is in the Dublin Midlands Hospital Group, and we don't have a statement from them, but we do have Ireland East Hospital Group, which a lot of people here in Kildare, West Wicklow, parts of Dublin, obviously, who tune in, day out, would be attending these hospitals. And this spokesperson said that they expect the majority of its 12 hospitals will have paid the pandemic special recognition award by the end of June. So they're going to do the majority of those working there by the end of this coming month. That is the Mater Hospital, St. Vincent's University Hospital, Our Lady's Hospital in Navan, the Regional Hospital in Mullingar, St. Luke's General Hospital, that's Carlow Kilkenny. Obviously, lots of our listeners may frequent that hospital. Wexford General Hospital, St. Cullum Kills Hospital, that's in Loughlinstown, then St. Michael's in Dunleary, then the National Orthopaedic Hospital in Kappa, the National Maternity Hospital, the Royal Victoria Eye and Ear Hospital, and the National Rehabilitation Hospital, again in Dublin. So the majority of those are to be paid by the end of June. As Tadhg was pointing out, approximately 45,000 full-time and part-time staff in the nursing home sectors will qualify for this payment between 600 and 1,000 euro. But as to when that will be rolled out, the Department of Health has still yet to give the final go-ahead. 350,000 people are approximately impacted by food poverty in Ireland. That's about 7% of the population. There's a new study. It's entitled Uncovering Food Poverty in Ireland, A Hidden Deprivation. And I'm joined now by the author of that study. That is Dr. Michael Drew. He has a PhD from the School of Social Policy, Social Work and Social Justice at University College Dublin. And as I was mentioning before the break, he's also researched food poverty in Ireland over a 5-year period. Good afternoon to you, Michael.
Hello, Ciara. Nice to talk to you.
Lovely to speak with you too. So quite an interesting piece of research here. It's worded as here providing compelling evidence of the need for additional policies to be adopted to support households on lower incomes and address food poverty. If we're to touch on that first, what additional policies would you be, as the author of a study like this, calling for or feel may be beneficial to people?
Well, I was delighted that when I launched my book today, we had the Minister, Joe O'Brien, attend. And I was able to explain to him that there are a number of social policies which contribute to the problem of food poverty. And it's not just a question of sorting out one particular issue and then we have the solution. So it's a number of issues coming together. For example, a number of people I met in my study are on low pay. So that is already a problem. And the government has committed within its life to committing to a living wage. So that would be increasing from the minimum wage to the living wage. So that's one aspect. But a lot of the people who are working, they're in precarious jobs. And that means short-term insecure jobs. And they can be there for a week and they can be gone. So we have relatively low employment protection in Ireland. So that's another little problem. And then when people are out of a job, they rely on social protection for their social welfare payments. And we know from research, because there's research on what the minimum social welfare payments needed are, we know that people are struggling on these payments. And also, we know there are other problems such as housing. I think everyone knows that there's a big problem of housing. And the government has, in fairness, made a major effort in that area. However, we see that there is still a significant issue with homelessness, and a lot of people I met as part of my study are having problems with the HAP payments and the other payments. And then on top of all of that, we have people who are they have disabilities or they have long-term illnesses, so they're relying on the health service, and there were delays in people going back to work because they were waiting for consultants' appointments, so we have issues with the health service, which impacts. And then we have issues to do with caring as well. So it's really a whole melting pot of different issues. And the people that I met that are getting food from food banks, they are normally experiencing at least one or two of these, if not three. So multiple problems.
Now, the book is over 200 pages. And you note that a lot of these problems exacerbated by COVID-19 and the pandemic, in particular those who are already at high risk of food poverty, which would include low-income families with children, lone parents, people with disabilities and renters. Obviously speaking about, you know, the housing assistance payment, for example.
Well, that's right, yes.
So if this is the case, they are the most at risk, meaning they are the most vulnerable in society at the moment. You're speaking about the minister who joined you, Joe O'Brien, for the launch of the book. Do you feel, you know, studies like this, obviously you put a huge amount of time and work into it, will make much of a difference to the government? Because even before a pandemic, we knew they were the groups of people that were vulnerable in our society.
Well, that's right. Generally, they're the same groups of people that come up in studies as being the most vulnerable. I think there isn't going to be one piece of evidence or one book or one report that's going to make a difference. But I was delighted that the minister attended the book launch. It's another piece of evidence, and it's further work alongside other work that Vincent de Paul and other charities are doing to promote social justice. So it is important, and the government does have a roadmap for social inclusion, and they do acknowledge the problem of food poverty in that, and there is a working group. So the government has targets to improve the situation. It's committed to a living wage, as I mentioned. It also has sustainable development goals, which are part of a UN initiative. A number of countries are involved in it. So it has a lot of targets. But what I want to see is that these targets are actually translating into action that will make a difference to these families. And that is where the difficulty comes, because often we have to wait what I think is too long before we see the action needed.
You've noted here that food poverty in 21st century Ireland remains largely overlooked.
Yes.
You've been researching it for over 5 years, so I'm going to assume around 2017 time, you know, 2.5, 3 years prior to a pandemic. If you are to compare with, say, literally today versus, the middle of 2017 or 2018, what are the glaring and obvious differences to you in terms of the situation of food poverty in the country?
Well, to be honest with you, I think that the situation was overall improving slightly, down from the peak in 2013-14 down to about 2018. But I have no doubt at all that the situation has gone much worse, because during COVID, there was much greater demand for help with food. And then recently, we see the spiraling cost of food, inflationary pressures. We've only got to look at the cost of butter, which has shot up in price. So this is going to affect all families. Now, being a researcher, I'm relying on official data, and that all takes time to work through the system. There's always a delay between having the official data, then working out what the figures are, and doing a report. But I think we all know that the situation recently, in terms of food shopping, has gone much worse. And this is inevitably going to translate into a much bigger problem with food poverty.
Yeah, we were just speaking about it this morning, actually, Michael, on our newspaper review on Kildare Today. Kantar had new research out. I spoke about it yesterday also. And we know that's a fact, as you're saying. You're a researcher and you deal with the data and the stats, and we know for a fact that food is increasing rapidly. Inflation still continuing to rise. And Michael, Dr. Michael Drew, that is the author of this study book, over 200 pages. It's entitled Uncovering Food Poverty in Ireland, A Hidden Deprivation. Michael has his PhD from the School of Social Policy, Social Work and Social Justice. That's at the University College in Dublin. And he has been researching food poverty in Ireland for over 5 years. And just to give a definition of food poverty, it is the inability to have an adequate and nutritious diet due to issues of affordability or accessibility. And in Ireland's government roadmap for social inclusion, it was estimated that 7% of the population were experiencing food poverty in 2018. As Michael just noted, that was, I guess, peaking from the low compared to 2013. This is in 2018. A lot has changed, obviously, in those 4 years since 2018. It's based on a measure of food poverty developed by the Economic and Social Research Institute and using data from the CSO Survey of Income and Living Conditions. So, obviously, things, as Michael noted, changing a lot over the 2+ years of this pandemic being declared. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. You may not know this, but today is World No Tobacco Day, and you can find your local Stop Smoking Clinic here in the county of Kildare. So figures do reveal that 18% of the Irish population are smokers, and they say, the public health experts, that is, that smokers will feel immediate health benefits from giving up the habit. Kind of an obvious one there, isn't it? Tobacco Free Ireland is encouraging people to give up as part of the World No Tobacco Day. So smoking causes over 4,500 deaths here each year, with the latest figures revealing 18%, as I mentioned, are smokers. Now, the HSE is increasing investment in its quit smoking supports. The latest figures show the number of smokers in lower socioeconomic groups is 3 times higher compared to those who are more well off. And the Taoiseach, he is making an address at the Tobacco Free Ireland conference today. He says that more supports will be targeted at communities with the highest levels of smoking. What is it now to buy a packet of cigarettes? Is it near something like 14 or 15 euro? Is it near 15, I think, maybe? And the last budget it's gotten closer to. So to let you know of the local clinics, one is Newbridge Stop Smoking Service. That is in Newbridge Health Centre on Henry Street. I have a phone number here for it, so I'll give it out. But if anybody does miss any of these calls or misses any of these numbers or these addresses, you can call in to us here. It's 045-898-999. That's KFM's number. And of course, we can give you out the information. So the number for the Newbridge Stop Smoking Service, 087-947-5786. Then Naas Community Stop Smoking Service is at the Vista Primary Care Centre on the Ballymore Eustace Road in Naas. And the number to contact there is 087-142-0249. Then further south in the County Athy Primary Care Centre's clinic is at the care centre at Shamrock Lodge in the town. You can call 087-251-5338. And then finally, back up to north of the county, Maynooth Health Centre, which is in the town, it's 087 1420249. That is advice for the four clinics in the county, the Stop Smoking Services, on this World No Tobacco Day. Now, earlier today, the Raise the Roof Housing campaign announced plans for a series of regional and national public meetings. This is on the housing crisis. It will take place over the coming weeks. And I'm joined now by the campaign's officer with Congress. That's the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, MacDara Doyle. Hello to you, MacDara.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for taking the time. I know Father Peter McVerry was speaking at the launch or the announcement, the official one earlier on, and he said the ban on eviction should be reinstated as Ireland gets to grip with the housing crisis. Please God, we're getting to grips with it. He was speaking at the launch, as I mentioned. It's holding, you know, a series of public speaking events to discuss the issue right around the country. In April, the Department of Housing released the figures. It revealed the number of people accessing accommodation was over 10,000. That's for the first time since February 2021, before the pandemic officially, I guess, hit the country in terms of lockdowns, etc. MacDara, what exactly will be taking place in terms of these public meetings? What can the public expect, and what do they need to organise, I guess, before attending?
Well, I suppose, like many campaign organisations and groupings, we're kind of fully emerging from the pandemic now. We were in a state of suspended animation somewhat during the pandemic. So we're kind of effectively relaunching the public phase of the Raise the Roof campaign, which is the largest single housing campaign network in the country. And we've pulled together initially an initial phase, a series of meetings taking place, as you said, around the country over the coming weeks, which start in Navan on June the 1st, Waterford on June the 7th, Limerick June the 13th, Dublin in the Mansion House on June the 21st, which is an event hosted by the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Galway on June 28th, and then in Maynooth, in your own neck of the woods, mm-hmm. on July the 4th, and that's in the Glenroy Hotel.
4th of July, okay.
Yeah.
What time is that, MacDara, just so I have all the info?
That'll be evening, 7:30 start, probably 7:30 closer time, but we'll probably have leaflets and stuff and publicity material for those closer to the time. What are people to expect? I mean, look, the point of this is to, I suppose, to engage with people around the country. I mean, this is two issues. This is not just a Dublin problem. This is a problem where you see the greatest concentration perhaps in Dublin, but this is a problem that extends well beyond the boundaries of the capital. It's national, it's across, it's in every town and village at this stage, and we need to get a sense of that regional experience or that experience outside Dublin, but also I suppose to build a broader kind of national movement, if you like, and also to give people a sense that actually it doesn't have to be the way it is, that there are options, there are alternatives, and there are different ways of doing things that could potentially resolve this crisis. The problem we have with housing policy going back certainly since Rebuilding Ireland, which was the precursor of the current plan, Housing mm-hmm. for All, if you look at the two of them, overall the policy is a case of us repeating the same mistakes and expecting different outcomes all the time. And I heard, you know, you mentioned Peter McVerry. I heard Peter McVerry on later talking about the fact that a few years ago he prophesied absolute disaster, that we could actually have up to 5,000 people homeless in the country if we didn't act fast.
And now it's double.
Over 10,000. Yeah. Right? And just to be clear, that's just the numbers that they actually count in emergency accommodation. Mm-hmm. There are probably about 30,000 and additional hidden homeless in there. And God knows how many people still stuck at home because they can't actually afford to move out, buy a house, or move on with their lives, or even rent.
I mean, absolutely, you took the words out of my mouth. And if we're just to focus, would say, on this county, for example, you mentioned it's not just happening in the capital city. A lot of people would say my age in their 20s, they would be, or even, you know, in their 30s, they would have been affected by the recession in terms of what happened with the banks and getting loans. If you want to just focus on that for a moment. But I know when I was growing up, if I ever went into Dublin, into the capital city, you would see some homeless people. Obviously, nowhere near as many as you're seeing nowadays, right? But I would never see it on the streets of my local town. And for example, now in that town, there are so many homeless people on the streets. We see it every day. The general public can see the changes every day. And they want to make a change in a greater way. They're not even so much focusing on themselves if they can't afford to buy for the first time, or they can't afford to even buy for the second time, whatever it may be, or have fallout from not repaying their mortgage and are now renting. Whatever the case may be, this whole county is a rent pressure zone. We, as the people of this county, realise the problems, but even when it comes to those who literally don't have a roof over their heads at night, that is becoming more and more prevalent in the smaller towns in this country. And as I'm saying, people are frustrated. So they don't just want to help themselves in terms of first-time buyers. They also want to help those literally sleeping on the streets.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, during COVID, prior to COVID, we were told that certain things were legally and constitutionally impossible. It was impossible to put a cap on or to freeze rents. It was and to ban rent rises. It was impossible to ban evictions. COVID arrived and the world turned upside down, and suddenly all of those things became possible. And for the first time in possibly a decade, there was some respite for people. And evictions slowed. Evictions virtually came to a halt. Homelessness dropped dramatically. Now, the reason for that is because evictions are the single greatest cause of homelessness in this country and in any other country. So the pandemic demonstrated to us that there are solutions if we're willing to actually just be a bit more creative and a bit more radical about this, that we can't keep going back to the same old policies and expecting different results, which is, after all, the definition of insanity.
As Einstein did say, yes. And with this campaign and the plans for the series of regional and national public meetings, you're speaking about radicalisation. You obviously want to get the power of the public behind yourselves at the Raise the Roof housing campaign to ensure that changes are made permanently.
The most important thing, as I said, is to give people, because I think what often happens is that people, if you live with something long enough, unfortunately, people tend to start despairing.
You become numb, don't you?
Yeah, you become numb, you become inured, it becomes normalised, and people start to give up hope that things can ever change. And we heard today, for example, the Phil Nihay, who's the Vice President of Congress of Trade Unions and also Head of the Nurses Union, talk about the impact on younger professionals or younger people qualifying, that now, probably for the first time, people now factor in accommodation and affordable housing as to where they might start their career. In other words, they might emigrate because they can't get housing here, and they might choose to start their career or start their work or entering the workforce elsewhere, because accommodation has now become such a dominant factor. We know also from multinationals who can't bring people into the country, skilled workers into the country that they need, because the cost of accommodation is too high. So the point here, as I said, is to show people that there are alternatives and demonstrate that there are different ways of doing things. The ban on evictions is just one. But, you know, I suppose probably the most important thing about this is, since 2009, 2010, and you go right back to the crash, there was a deliberate policy decision taken in this country that the state would stop building public housing. So thousands of houses that would be built every year are suddenly taken out of the system. And that caused a huge backlog, and that has completely skewed the housing sector. And you have a problem now where, I mean, it depends on how you approach housing and how you see housing. We see it as a human right and as a public good, the right to shelter. The way education is seen as a public good. And if you approach it from that perspective, then you see that the state should have a much more active role in trying to shape the market to deliver affordable homes for people, to deliver public housing where it's required, to deliver secure accommodation where it's required. Because this is affecting so many people at so many levels across whole sectors of society.
I don't think anybody can argue with that, MacDara. Unfortunately, we could speak about this for a long time. I don't have that time this afternoon. Thank you for joining me. That is the campaigns officer with Congress, the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, MacDara Doyle, on the Raise the Roof housing campaign today. Announced plans for a series of regional and national public meetings on the housing crisis, which will take place over the coming weeks. Basic message there from MacDara is don't give up hope. These meetings will be taking place across the country. The first is in Navan in County Meath on the 1st of June, and one taking place in Maynooth in County Kildare on the 4th of July at the Glen Royal Hotel. We'll have more information as it comes, but it's the Raise the Roof housing campaign. Caoimhe will have more of those details up on our website in the next few minutes. That's kfmradio.com. So check it out there to find out more.